Thank you for dialing in for today's conference call. All lines are on listen only as we begin our conference for today. During the Q&A session of our call, you will be prompted to press star one on your touch-tone phone. Please be sure to unmute your line to record your name so that I may introduce you to ask your question. Our conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I will now turn the conference over to our host, Mr. Ahmad Khan. Sir, you may proceed.
Thank you, Jill. Good afternoon. I'm Ahmad Khan, and I'm representing the Clinician Outreach and Communication Activity, COCA, with the Emergency Risk Communications Branch at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. I am delighted to welcome you to today's COCA call, Synthetic Cannabinoids, Information and Guidance for Clinicians. You may participate in today's presentation by audio only, via webinar, or you may download the slides if you are unable to access the webinar. The PowerPoint slide set and the webinar link can be found on our COCA webpage at emergency.cdc.gov/COCA. Click on March 31st COCA call. The slide set is located under call materials. Free continuing education is offered for this COCA call. Instruction on how to earn continuing education will be provided at the end of the call. CDC, our planners, presenters, and their spouses' partners wish to disclose they have no financial interest or other relationships with the manufacturers of commercial products, suppliers of commercial services, or commercial supporters. Planners have reviewed content to ensure there is no bias. This presentation will not include any discussion of the unlabeled use of a product or products under investigational use. At the end of the presentation, you will have the opportunity to ask the presenters questions. On the phone, dialing star 1 will put you in the queue for questions. You may submit questions through the webinar system at any time during the presentation by selecting the Q&A tab at the top of the webinar screen and typing in your question. Questions are limited to clinicians who would like information. For those who have media questions, please contact CDC Media Relations at 404-639-3286 or send an email to media@cdc.gov. If you are a patient, please refer your questions to your healthcare provider. At the conclusion of today's session, the participant will be able to describe the epidemiology and clinical effects of synthetic cannabinoid use, discuss recent clusters of severe disease associated with synthetic cannabinoid use in the U.S., identify opportunities for clinicians to support surveillance and response efforts. Today's first presenter is Dr. Amelia Casper. Dr. Casper is currently a second-year EIS officer with the National Center for Environmental Health, Health Studies Branch. She received a Master's of Health Sciences degree in Environmental Health Sciences and medical training at St. Louis University. She completed her internship and residency in internal medicine at Barnes Jewish Hospital, Washington University in St. Louis, followed by a postdoctoral fellowship in epidemiology at the Yale School of Public Health. Our second presenter is Dr. Robert Galley. Dr. Galley graduated from Yale University School of Medicine, where he completed his internal medicine residency. At UCLA Medical Center, he completed his emergency medicine residency and medical toxicology training. Under his direction, emergency medicine was established as a formal department at the University of Mississippi Medical Center in 1994 and includes air care, medical toxicology, and the SANE program. Today's third presenter is Dr. Justin Arnold. Dr. Arnold is a medical toxicologist and emergency medicine physician with the University of Alabama at Birmingham School of Medicine. Dr. Arnold completed his residency in emergency medicine at Lehigh Valley Health Network in Allentown, Pennsylvania, and a fellowship in medical toxicology at Emory University and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta, Georgia. Dr. Arnold has participated in field investigations pertaining to the epidemic use and health consequences associated with synthetic cannabinoid use. Additionally, he serves as Associate Medical Director for Alabama's only poison center at the Regional Poison Control Center at Children's of Alabama, where he provides medical oversight for center's operation. At this time, please welcome Dr. Casper.
So, hi, everyone. So Okay, so to get us started this afternoon, I'm going to provide a brief overview of synthetic cannabinoids, their emerging threat to public health, and a bit about what we do and don't know about them at this time. And then finally, I'll discuss potential future directions for public health and the healthcare community to work together to address this threat. Dr. Galley will be going into more detail about the specifics later in this call, but briefly, synthetic cannabinoids, or SCs, are a family of man-made chemicals that bind to the same receptors as THC, the major psychoactive component of marijuana. I do want to stress at this time that these products are not in any way related to marijuana. Synthetic cannabinoid products are readily available and can be purchased through dealers, convenience stores, or on the internet. The chemicals are generally manufactured overseas and then sent to the U.S. for processing into the final product and packaged. The empty packets can be purchased on eBay, as you can see here, as a variety pack with different product names included. This is important because just because a packet says Crazy Monkey on it doesn't mean that it's the same Crazy Monkey that you had yesterday. In reality, the contents of these packages are completely unregulated. They can contain one SC, many SCs, or even other hazardous substances of completely unknown concentration. These packets are often printed with not for human consumption to get around certain laws. However, many states now have general laws banning the manufacture, distribution, or possession of SCs, regardless of what is listed on the package. A handful of SCs have been placed into Schedule 1 of the Federal Controlled Substances Act. And again, Dr. Galley will be covering this in more detail later. I'd now like to present a timeline of the emergence of SCs as a public health threat. SCs were first synthesized in the 1960s, around the same time that the active ingredients in marijuana were being isolated. Research into these compounds as possible therapeutic agents for multiple sclerosis, cancer, and other diseases began to gain traction in the 1980s, which led to a better understanding of cannabinoid receptor structure and the pathways involved. In 1986, the Controlled Substance Analog Enforcement Act, also known as the Federal Analog Act, was signed into law in an attempt to address designer drugs just hitting the market at that time. There are multiple loopholes in this law, however, including one that I mentioned on the last slide. To be considered a controlled substance analog under this act, a substance needs to be made for human consumption. So continuing on our timeline, in 2004, the first reports of SCs being sold online and in Western Europe arose, and by November of 2008, distribution was confirmed in the U.S. with the seizure of a shipment in Dayton, Ohio. In 2009, Germany became the first country to criminalize SCs specifically, banning two individual compounds. Manufacturers quickly circumvented this legislation by slightly changing the chemical composition and introducing a new compound into the market. And in 2011, in light of increasing use nationwide, the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration placed five SCs in Emergency Schedule 1 of the Controlled Substances Act, thereby making it illegal to manufacture, distribute, and possess these SCs. Schedule 1 drugs have no known accepted medical use and have a high potential for abuse. In 2012, 51 new SCs were identified compared to two new SCs in 2009. In this year, the Synthetic Drug Abuse Prevention Act, which is part of the FDA Safety and Innovation Act of 2012, banned five different structural classes of SCs. In spite of increased legislation, the use of SCs continued to increase as well. In 2015, a multi-state outbreak of adverse events from SCs occurred, which in some places continues to this day. This outbreak has been linked to a novel SC called MAB Chibinacca. So to reiterate, synthetic cannabinoid use has become widespread over the last 5 years or so. Now I'll talk about why this is a problem. First, the number of reports of adverse events related to these substances has increased, reaching an all-time high in 2015, with outbreaks of these adverse events occurring in multiple states. The number of exposure calls to poison centers jumped from 2,700 in 2013 to 7,800 in 2015. Because of the unpredictable nature of the contents and the constant introduction of new SCs on the market, the clinical effects of SCs are not consistent and can be severe. For example, SCs have been linked to acute kidney injury, cardiac events, psychosis, and seizures. Though unpredictable, it appears that over time, the severity of illness associated with SCs has been increasing. There are a number of theories of why this might be happening, including simply an increased awareness and reporting of these adverse events. Another thought is that since newer SCs are being developed so rapidly, there hasn't been time to learn about their pharmacokinetics or how they bind to the cannabinoid receptor, so it's possible that these newer compounds cause more severe health effects. One reason for the increase in use is that there is widespread misperception about the safety and legality of these substances, not only among the general public, but also among the medical and public health community. And finally, one particular challenge faced by both public health and the medical community is that the contents of these products are completely unpredictable. The concentration of the active ingredient can vary significantly between batches or even within the same batch. These products can contain novel SCs, blends of SCs, or other psychoactive substances such as PCP or toxic chemicals such as formaldehyde. To better illustrate this problem, I'd like to discuss four recent outbreaks. First, an outbreak in multiple states occurred in February 2012. In this outbreak, the Wyoming Department of Health was first made aware of four previously healthy individuals who developed acute kidney injury after smoking SC products. The state launched a multi-state collaboration between public health officials, laboratorians, toxicologists, and health providers to further investigate, ultimately identifying 16 individuals who developed acute kidney injury in six states. These patients initially presented with flank pain, nausea, and vomiting. Ultimately, an SC called XLR11 was detected in 8 of 16 of these patients. Two outbreaks in the fall of 2013, one in Colorado and one in Georgia, were both linked to an SC called ADB Pinaca. In Colorado, 221 people with agitated delirium linked to cannabinoid use were seen in EDs throughout the state. 10 of these individuals were ultimately admitted to the ICU. And in Georgia, 22 patients were seen in a single emergency department for agitated delirium with 6 eventual ICU admissions. Neither of these outbreaks were associated with any deaths. And then, in the spring of 2015, a multi-state outbreak of adverse events related to SCs affected over 700 people in at least 6 states. This outbreak was unprecedented in terms of size and severity. In Mississippi alone, over 700 people, including 9 deaths, were linked to SC use. Going back to data from poison centers from this time, calls for SC exposures nationwide jumped 330% between January 2015 and April 2015. Typical adverse events were altered mental status, specifically agitated delirium, confusion, and somnolence. The predominant SC identified in this most recent outbreak was MAB Chibinacca. However, in Mississippi, 44% of patients who tested positive for SCs tested positive for multiple SC compounds, suggesting that blends of SCs are common. So what do we know at this time? These products are generally smoked, but there are reports of vaping, ingesting, or snorting them in powdered form. And why do people use these products? Well, first, they're generally cheaper than marijuana. A gram of SCs costs somewhere between $5 to $10 compared to a starting price of about $20 per gram of marijuana. While they're generally no longer openly displayed at convenience store or head shop counters, SCs are still readily available, oftentimes behind the counter at these same stores as well as online or through dealers. SCs do have psychoactive effects, and the desire for a novel high is cited as a reason for using them. Anecdotally, some users seek out SCs reported to have severe health effects, with a thought that there may also be associated more desirable psychoactive effects as well. The pervasive myth that these products are legal has led to the misbelief that somehow SCs are as safe or even safer than marijuana. And finally, these products are not detected on standard urine immunoassays, making them an attractive option for people who want to use a psychoactive substance while evading standard drug testing. We've seen use of these substances in both rural and urban areas throughout the country. Users are predominantly young men in their 20s and 30s. Previously published literature has shown that the people who use these substances frequently use other drugs, including marijuana. And while use has been reported in all socioeconomic and racial groups, clusters of illness have been recently reported in adolescents, in the prison population, the military, and the homeless. The lower cost and the desire to avoid positive drug tests make synthetic cannabinoid products attractive alternatives to marijuana in these populations. At this time, there are many gaps in our knowledge. First, we don't know what the baseline number of SC users and the patterns of use are. Next, the health effects of new SC compounds that are being continuously introduced into the market have proven to be unpredictable. The effects are for the most part nonspecific, and no particular toxidrome has emerged, making it challenging to diagnose intoxication based on clinical effects alone. Further complicating matters, only a couple of specialized research labs in the U.S. have the capability to detect novel synthetic cannabinoids in either product or biological samples. And, as I mentioned before, a rapid diagnostic test for SCs that are already known isn't available either. Treatment options are largely supportive at this point. There are no anecdotes or specific therapies. We don't know enough about the pharmacology or pharmacokinetics of these drugs to be able to provide specific patient care recommendations. And finally, we don't know what the long-term effects of using these drugs are. It does appear that some users describe a sort of dependence to these drugs and have withdrawal symptoms when they try to stop use, but this has not been well described. Also, standardized recommendations for counseling and treatment have not been made. So what are our next steps? Continued collaboration and communication between poison centers, state and local health departments, the CDC, healthcare facilities, law enforcement, and the DEA is critically important in order to understand and mitigate the public health impact of SCs. Case clusters are expected to continue to occur, and developing a baseline understanding of the extent of SC use and a better understanding of the typical clinical effects of SCs would help alert medical and public health professionals to a cluster of illness or a new clinical effect. Healthcare providers should be encouraged to report suspected clusters, which will help inform medical and public health professionals of evolving outbreaks. The more we learn about synthetic cannabinoids and their use, the more equipped we will be to develop informed diagnosis and treatment guidelines. And finally, we also recommend targeted messaging for high-risk populations and healthcare providers to increase awareness of this problem and to ultimately improve patient care. One message to healthcare providers would be to consider SC intoxication in patients with mental status changes who have negative drug screens. Also, reporting illnesses that you suspect are linked to SCs to your local poison center or health department will help public health identify clusters of illness quickly and rapidly respond if needed. And Dr. Arnold will be talking more about the importance of a close collaboration between healthcare providers, public health, and poison centers in his talk. And that is all I have for you this afternoon, and I'll pass the podium on to Dr. Galley.
Well, thank you very much. I'm at the University of Mississippi Medical Center, and as was mentioned by Dr. Casper, there was a significant outbreak in our state, and probably the best cataloged event that we have to date. It started in early April when I received a call. I was on call for the poison center. We had four patients in our emergency department, all screaming that they were on spice. And while we see spice on a regular basis, there was really nothing super special except the numbers. And in fact, within the next couple of weeks, we had greater than 400 patients reported statewide. And our biggest concern, of course, was that six potential deaths were associated with that. I'll give you the final numbers as we get towards the end. There were a lot of rumors around the state as to what this could be. Was this bath salts? And some coroner said MDMA and spice. MDMA, of course, is ecstasy. People were wondering how they can control patients, and they wanted to take them down with a ketamine dart, which was really what you use for elephants. And more importantly, I want to be able to emphasize the term synthetic marijuana really is a misnomer, as Dr. Casper has suggested. These are cannabinoids. They have nothing to do with marijuana. They are dangerous drugs that are really quite different. The formula you see on the left is what real THC is. That's what Mother Nature has made, and it's been a relatively safe drug throughout the eons. I'm not a great chemist myself, but I can certainly recognize that the formula on the right-hand side is certainly not the same thing, and that is a synthetic cannabinoid. That is the original spice JWH018. Mother Nature makes a couple of different chemicals. The one on the left, again, is THC, tetrahydrocannabinol. The one on the right is cannabidiol, which is the chemical that's now being studied with no psychological effects, but perhaps very effective in controlling intractable seizures in children in particular. So let's look at some of the drugs that we have that are out in population. Tobacco deaths, almost 500,000 a year, and we know that tobacco is a problem, illegal as it is. Alcohol, similarly, 27,000. Now, these are numbers from 2011, and I will tell you that 2011 is kind of a hallmark year, and it'll come up several times during the talk. 27,000 alcohol deaths, not from car wrecks, but just from the alcohol effects itself. prescription painkillers back then was 17,000. We know it's a lot higher than that. Cocaine, perhaps about stable. Heroin deaths at 4,000, we know is a lot higher now. But notice marijuana deaths. Year after year, there have been no reported deaths associated with marijuana, which I could confidently talk about up until this last year when some jerk was being followed by the cops and he swallowed his bag of weed, choked to death on it. So I'm not so sure that's a direct effect of the marijuana. But in general, marijuana is a pretty safe drug. Not so with synthetic cannabinoids. THC is a partial agonist, combining with or connecting to the cannabinoid binding site 1 in the CNS. These are full agonists, which means they are anywhere between 10 and 200 times stronger than THC. First developed, as was mentioned, way back into the 80s, there are several different series of these, and these were put together by drug companies and by college university chemists. JWH-018 is the first spice, and called spice only because it was packaged in a little container that somebody made the name up. But this was John William Huffman, hence JWH, and 018 was the first one that was discovered in this bag of potpourri. AM2201, Alexandros Makrianos, is a chemist who put together the first K2. But notice there's several of the series. Again, these were drugs that were being studied carefully by university and pharmaceutical chemists who were trying to come up with precursors of drugs that could potentially be used for analgesics, for muscle spasms of multiple sclerosis, maybe as anti-nausea agents for chemotherapy patients. And so there were significant studies looking at the pharmacokinetics of these drugs because the understanding was that these would be consumed by human beings. That has substantially changed. So here's JWH-018, that spice on the left, and on the right you'll notice that is K2. The slight difference that you'll find is that there's a fluoride group versus the methyl group, and that really is the only difference in these two chemicals when they were first introduced. Again, they were labeled as not for human consumption, but it was only up until 2008 when they were studied in Europe that it was determined that these little bags of potpourri were actually basically vehicles for drug use. This is a little bit blurry, but in the United States in 2010, we had 3,000 calls to poison centers across the country. That doubled in 2011 to just a little under 6,000. And we were figuring, my goodness, there's something significant about this. 6,000 calls, that's dramatic. Again, 2010 to 2011. Well, there is a group at the University of Michigan called Monitoring the Future, and they have an annual study that they look at kids in grade school and in high school. This is the view of what the seniors looked like in 2011. Notice that marijuana was the most commonly abused drugs among seniors in high school at 36%. But second on that list was synthetic marijuana, they called it, unfortunately, but that's 11%. That's 11% of 3.5 million seniors. So that's 375,000 people that are using or were using in 2011 synthetic cannabinoids. And those are only seniors in high school. So you can imagine that this has been under the radar for quite some period of time. As it turns out, I am told that the reactions from smoking marijuana are dry mouth, increased breathing rate, increased appetite, relaxation, and synthetic cannabinoids do essentially the same thing. Marijuana also, from the psychological effect, is meant to be a feeling of relaxation. People do recreational drugs not because they want to get naked and run in the street. They want to have some sense of a good effect, of a relaxing effect. Paranoia and anxiety, of course, happens when you see the blue lights in your rearview mirror. But in essence, the synthetic cannabinoids do exactly the same thing. But unfortunately, what we're seeing in them now is 10 to 200 times stronger. So again, synthetic cannabinoids have a similar desired effect as THC. In 2010, David Mitchell Rosga, unfortunately, a teen from Iowa, shot himself in the head, and his friends admitted that he had been smoking K2 the hour before that. So the association was fairly obvious. Similarly, right after that, Chuck Grassley, his state senator, introduced legislation that Dr. Casper referred to, and that made Schedule One drugs out of the synthetic cannabinoids with which we were familiar. In 2012, it was understood that there were a heck of a lot more of these, and so they were all included under Schedule One, which means if you smoked them, or if you sold them, if you bought them and you were caught, you would go to jail. Unfortunately, it also meant that researchers would have a really hard time trying to be able to get a hold of them to look at some of the effects that they were having. It also meant that if these were illegal, then modifications were going to be made, and they were made by rogue chemists, typically in China, which adjusted the formulation of these drugs somewhat. And so what we're seeing over the years, here's JWH-018, and you can see how that modified AM-2201, we talked about this one little fluoride change. Through the years, the chemicals changed rather substantially, but each time only a modest change. Dr. Casper mentioned ABD Pinaca. Of late, AB Kiminaca and MAB Kiminaca are the key drugs. AB Kiminaca was popular on the streets in October of 2014. It was reported that across the country there were some 200 exposures and six deaths associated with it. The DEA did what was called a fast-tracking maneuver in order to be able to make that illegal, and as a result, technically, that was now Scheduled One. What we found was a slight change. Instead of this, we had this, which is a methyl group, hence the MAB Kiminaca, and each of the letters in each of these names are associated with a part of the chemical themselves, and it turns out this was the new drug that came out in April of this last year. So while you might have certain effects from the true tetrahydrocannabinol, what we were seeing now was much higher levels of hypertension and tachycardia. Deaths were probably associated with dysrhythmias. We had one reported case, and again, this was now the beginning of April of last year, so just about a year ago. The ambulance people mentioned to me that they had had a death, that there was one guy who was in a club who took one hit off of somebody's pipe, dropped dead on the floor. Literally, you'd have to assume that that would be some type of a dysrhythmia. What we started seeing quite more frequently, however, were the psychological effects, which was hallucinations and psychosis that were really quite substantial. This was from the cover of the New York Times, and this, unfortunately, is what happens to the end result of an awful lot of our players who come in just so agitated that in order to control them and to protect the healthcare workers, they really need to be sedated. These are the chemists that put these chemicals together, unfortunately, and there was one arrest that was made in Jackson at around that same time. What they used was something that was called formaric acid, but that we know was not, and it came in a 2-kilo bag, and it was mixed with Damiana leaf. Basically, the process here is to have some type of herbal so that you can douse this. You can see that we have all of these plastic bins. And so the Damiana leaf is put in the bins, and it is dissolved in acetone. This is probably the equivalent of what they use for a fan in the hood. You can tell this was really not very sophisticated. So here in the bucket, you'll find the chemical. It is hydrophobic, which means that you cannot dissolve it in water, and so acetone is used. And a couple of gallons of acetone would now dissolve the chemical, which is then sprayed on the Damiana leaf, and now you have your product. In one place, in order to try to get some quality control, they used a cement mixer to make sure that it was evenly distributed. Packaged in bags like this, or even in just regular plastic bags, it is sold on the street quite inexpensively. When we noticed this outbreak in our state, we asked all the hospitals to try to collect some samples to us. We sent over 200 to UCSF, where they were able to determine that 64% were MAB Kiminaca, which was this new chemical that now had finally hit the street. But it was not isolated to just MAB Kiminaca. They found all of these other chemicals as well associated with samples that we collected across the state, either from blood and urine or from actual herbal samples themselves. So what do we see? In particular, this is important for people in the EMS field. it's going to be agitation, and it can be really quite severe. We found that Zyprexa and Geodone were probably the best drugs in order to be able to control them. Elevated creatinines were common once we got them into the emergency department. And just like with PCP, when they are really using their muscles incredibly, they're breaking down some muscle tissues, and you'd see it a lot. In many cases, they came in totally fine. We had one mom who saw her son was a little bit altered and heard all the news that he had this horrible chemical. Basically, she just ruined his eye as far as he was concerned. But in most other cases, when they present to the healthcare providers, they are going to be significantly agitated, and if severely agitated, really the only way to be able to control them is with paralysis and intubation once you get them to the emergency department. To give you an idea how things changed for us, you can see here that from January until the end of March, we would see in the state of Mississippi, and these are data from the entire state of EMS runs, 0 to 5 cases a day. It was only with this outbreak of MAB Kiminaka that we were getting as much as 24 cases in a single day across the state. The numbers eventually came to 1,263 cases in the state of Mississippi that we were able to catalog in an 8-week period of time. 14% of those were treated and released in the emergency department. Almost 60% required at least 23-hour observation. Admissions, full admissions, were 22%, many of those associated with psychiatry service, and 5% of those had to be in the intensive care unit. Unfortunately, we had as many as 17 people who died in our state, and that really is what's so problematic about this. Right now, where we go, well, the DEA and the Mississippi Bureau of Narcotics are surveying the Internet to try to see what's going out on the web these days, and there are several new chemicals that apparently are in the pipeline. As was mentioned, CDC, Public Health, really want to be able to catalog this, and Dr. Arnold is going to be discussing that to a greater degree. And I'm just going to throw this out as perhaps blasphemous, but I have a colleague who graduated here and is now doing a medical toxicology fellowship in Colorado, and as you're well aware, they have legalized marijuana in the state of Colorado. As I mentioned, this horrible outbreak that we had and the deaths associated with, he said he's not seen any spice whatsoever. That's because everybody's buzzed up on marijuana, the relatively safe drug, and they had none of the similar complications that we were seeing. Oregon, Alaska, D.C. are the areas that are now starting to do this. I think we need to watch tentatively as to what happens, but there is no question that the synthetic cannabinoids right now, particularly when they are just being ad lib changed and thrown out to the populace, are really quite the dangerous set of chemicals. And with that, I will pass this on to Dr. Arnold.
Okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit about the interaction between practitioners, poison centers, and public health, and how we can all work together to further address these issues. So a little bit of history. I think most people are pretty familiar with poison centers as a resource for poisonings and overdoses, but I kind of want to delineate how poison centers have also evolved to really serve in a broader public health capacity. Originally, poison centers were developed out of Chicago in 1953. They kind of quickly expanded to offering their services to public and layperson callers. At one point, in the 1970s, we were seeing as many as 600 poison centers across the country. The American Association of Poison Control Centers, or AAPCC, then began to regionalize these services, and then we saw a pretty impressive consolidation of these centers, as well as more consistent services that they provided throughout the 1980s and 1990s. There were two things that were really significant in the early 2000s that really, I think, pushed poison centers to be able to help in the public health effort. One being the amendment of Title 12 of the Public Health Services Act in 2003, which allowed poison centers to function as a public health capacity. And then two, in 2006, there was an implementation of a web-based electronic reporting system for all poison centers. And we'll talk more detail about that and how we can use that for both epidemiologic purposes as well as research purposes. Poison centers today, there are 55 poison centers as of 2014 across the United States. They're seeing over 2.1 million calls for human exposures, over 56,000 calls for animal exposures, and about 600,000 calls for information, questions about drugs, medications, and safety. Additionally, poison centers are also reporting about 2.6 million outgoing calls where poison centers are following up on patients and that they were called on initially. You can see the dots kind of scattered throughout the United States, and like I said, it does cover all 50 states, as well as Washington, D.C., Puerto Rico, the U.S. Virgin Islands, Guam, American Samoa, and the Federated States of Micronesia. Now, this number is also, if you look at this from a national base, this is a call every 14.6 seconds that the poison centers are receiving. Poison centers are also staffed 24 hours a day, every day of the year, and their services are both free of charge to the end user as well as confidential. Again, we manage exposure calls, so if you've had an exposure to a medication, or information calls if you have a question about a medication or drug. And again, we do follow-up calls as well to kind of close the loop with these individuals. Again, the poison centers today address both the lay public as well as medical professionals, and you'll see there's a significant amount of overlap, so the communication is oftentimes communicated a little bit differently. Lay public can call regarding accidental poisonings, ingestions, as well as envenomations. They can call for information on pill identification. Poison centers also provide education to their communities, and some, though not many, poison centers also provide pet calls. Medical professionals, when they call, can also address some of the same issues, but will get more specific treatment recommendations, again, pill identification, and most poison centers also offer a consultation with a medical toxicologist so that there's medical professionals at the physician level who have a significant amount of expertise in toxicology that can offer that to the caller. There are also public health benefits, and if you look at poison centers, this is really delineated into five different key functions. First, the poison centers are accessible and affordable. There's no direct cost to the end user. Information is only a call away, and people know how to reach the poison center. Second, there's also large reductions in healthcare costs associated with poison centers. There's been estimates in 1997 that poison centers across the country decreased ED visits by roughly 350,000 visits for non-toxic exposures, and that correlated to a total cost savings in 1997 of more than $310 million. It also has been known to decrease length of stay. There's also toxico and public health surveillance efforts, and we'll talk about more of this in just a moment. Fourth, there's also a focus on education for both the lay public as well as the medical profession for medical education, teaching nursing and pharmacy students, medical students, residents, and medical toxicology fellows. And then finally, there's also research. And we'll talk again a little bit about this and how that web-based electronic reporting system has really kind of pushed the research effort further along. Now, poison centers, if we talk about organization, poison centers are going to be led by both a managing director, who's usually a pharmacist or a nurse, with the certification by ABAT, which is the American Board of Applied Toxicology, as well as a medical director, who's a physician who's board-certified in medical toxicology. The core of, really, a poison center is the SPIES, which is a specialist in poison information. These are the frontline call takers who have received special training, oftentimes only available at the poison centers. Most of these will be pharmacists or nurses. There's a select group of SPIES that kind of have an additional amount of training as well as a certification called a C-SPI, a Certified Specialist in Poison Information. And they receive a significant amount of education, again, logging more than 2,000 calls, more than 2,000 hours on the phones of the poison centers, and a relatively difficult examination. This graph shows the number of calls per day, and I apologize, it's a little bit small on the screen here, but the number of calls per day of human exposures are in red. In blue are the number of information calls, and the line on the bottom that's green are the number of animal calls. You can see that there is seasonal variation where we see peak calls in the summer and trough calls in the winter. And you can also see that there's an overall slightly downward trend in the number of calls for exposures the poison centers are getting, though we know the number from healthcare providers as well as the complexity of the calls are going up. And if you look here, you'll see of all the calls that poison centers do receive, still over 93% of them originate from individual residences and not necessarily for healthcare providers. So this is significant because what this really tells us is that patients, individuals, and the lay public know that we're around and they know how to reach us. The National Poison Data System is the web-based tool that was introduced in 2006 that I mentioned earlier, and it's a very significant tool that exists. This is something that's the only near real-time public health surveillance tool that exists in the United States at this time. It actively monitors, it's actually monitored by the AAPCC as well as the CDC and some public health departments for anomalies that may rise to the level of being a public health threat. And again, some poison centers and health departments also use this for anomaly identification. It also serves as a repository for all the data obtained by the U.S. poison centers. So every poison center across the country automatically uploads their cases in near real time every 8 minutes. So it's very easy to really get a very good grasp, and you're only 8 minutes potentially behind on real-time national data. This flow sheet shows us how information goes into the MPDS system as well as the end users, and what you can see is the boxes that are shaded gray are going to be entities that put information into MPDS, while the white boxes are going to be the end users. And you can see the general public as well as healthcare professionals and practitioners will call the poison centers. The poison centers upload the information to MPDS, and the MPDS is accessed by regional poison centers, CDC, the AAPCC surveillance team, as well as, again, some state and local health departments. And what's interesting about this, the MPDS system, again, is the data is continuously monitored using very specific surveillance algorithms. So these algorithms look for things like the total human call volume over a certain time. It looks for clinical effects, total numbers over a certain number of time, as well as case-based specific volumes. So if we're looking for a specific exposure to a substance, ricin would be a good example. We would want to know every time one case of ricin is reported, but we may also want to know, like in this case, if marijuana or synthetic cannabinoids are being reported above a determined threshold. And the way that this does, the way we do this is the MPDS actually is based on historical averages from the same location in the same time period using previous MPDS data. So it's so many standard deviations above what the average norm was for the same time in the same place that the data is being uploaded from. And again, once something reaches the level of an anomaly, that's going to be reported automatically and alert the AAPCC surveillance team, the CDC Health Studies Branch, as well as a designee for the Poison Center, as well and the State Public Health Department. This is an example of 11 of the case-based definitions the CDC uses to identify these anomalies. And some of these you can see are very simple. For example, if you look down to Ciguatera, simply an exposure that's reported and logged as an exposure to Ciguatera will generate an alert. Other things like ricin, for example, if ricin is recorded, that will also generate alert, but we also use syndromic surveillance as well for something like ricin. So if an individual calls a poison center and says that they're hypotensive, they're in renal failure, they've got an increased CK, and they're not a mushroom ingestion, that will trigger a potential alert for ricin, and then that would end up being reviewed further in detail to see if this really was a case of ricin or not. So again, when you look at the MPDS data flow, the information that does come in really is critical to get back to the practitioners. So we really see that state and local health departments, once they use this information to identify a public health threat, will turn around and implement public health interventions, HON alerts, different things like that back to the practitioners. So it really is the data coming in is really important so that the data that goes out can be helpful to the end users, and that particularly would be the health professionals. So poison centers do have an expanded role in public health threats, particularly in augmenting the response. So we can customize surveillance definitions based on the current threat, as well as access and share the information, and also look at national aggregate data as well. So this information can be shared with public health, regulatory agencies, government agencies as well, so that everybody's kind of on the same page and really looking at real-time relevant information. The other thing that poison centers really have are in a good position to expand on is that they're always staffed. So some states currently are using poison centers with additional funding to do things like public health after-hours lines to assist in outbreak information and messaging and monitoring. And a good example like that would have been Ebola and flu. Many poison centers had a hotline that would answer questions and direct patients on questions with Ebola and flu. And again, it also serves as a centralized data repository. So MPDS is excellent at really collecting that information in near real time and getting it quickly to the end users. And this is what actually was the really probably strongest thing that we saw with the synthetic cannabinoid outbreak in April of 2015. So again, the key collaborations, I think going forward, to rapidly collect the data, interpret the data, and integrate it, it really is important that we have practitioners playing a key role in reporting cases, reporting symptoms accurately. We need to have the state and local health departments in a position to really receive this information, use this information, and put the information back out to the practitioners. And poison centers, again, I think have to maintain a degree of flexibility, and I think are well prepared to and adapt to respond to the public health emergencies. So again, the synthetic cannabinoid outbreak in Mississippi is a great example of the collaboration with contributors and users of the poison center data. So initially in this outbreak, the Mississippi Department of Health reached out to practitioners using a data collection tool and a HON message. That data was collected by the Mississippi Department of Health as well as the Mississippi Poison Control Center. It was entered into NPDS, and then the NPDS data was used to look at identification of new cases, demographics, clinical features, as well as the severity of cases and outcomes. And that was also compared to national data that the CDC provided us and allowed us to kind of track this outbreak across the country. and then in the end, what that really translated to is the Mississippi Department of Health was able to provide guidance and public health interventions, resources, and tools to the practitioners that were actually on the front lines managing these. So again, there's really, I think, an important emphasis here on the collaboration between practitioners, poison centers, and health departments going forward, especially in outbreaks just like this. And these are my references, and I'll turn it back over to Mr. Khan.
Thank you, presenters, for providing our COCA audience with such a wealth of information. We will now open up the lines for the question and answer session. Questions are limited to clinicians only. For those who may have media questions, please contact CDC Media Relations at 404-639-3286 or send an email to media@cdc.gov. If you're a patient, please refer your questions to your healthcare provider. When asking a question, please state your organization, and also remember you can submit questions through the webinar system as well. Jill, please open the line for questions and answers.
Thank you so much. At this time, if you would like to ask a question over the phone, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone. Please record your name and organization to be introduced into the call. Once again, it is star 1 at this time.
While we're waiting for the first question on the phone, I would like to pose a question to the presenters that we received through the webinar system. The question states, the SCs that can be ingested or snorted by the individual, have you seen any increased adverse effects with one route over the other?
This is Dr. Galley. Speaking from the clinical perspective, no. Most all the time, though, they are either smoked or vaped. It seems to be the most popular route of administration. Again, we don't know how many of them are getting the intended high. All we see is the people are the people who wind up having an adverse outcome.
And this is Amy Casper. Just to reiterate that, definitely the majority of reports that come out say that people are mostly smoking these substances. The ingestion and the snorting are very rare, and we really don't know much. They're so rare we don't really know what the effects of that are.
Thank you. Jill, do we have a question on the phone?
We have one question. It's from Sylvia Nye. Ms. Nye, please state your organization.
Thank you very much. It's been answered.
Thank you, ma'am. One moment, please.
While we're waiting for the next question, I have another question in the webinar system I would like to ask. This question is directed towards Dr. Casper. How is CDC working with public health departments on this issue?
So, thank you. This is Amy Casper. Yes, so we are available to at any point if anyone has any questions or would like technical assistance. Our branch is happy to provide that. We have had experience with multiple health departments over the past year who've reached out to us to ask about how best to respond to the outbreaks that they're experiencing in their states. We're also going to be having a panel discussion at the upcoming Council for State and Territorial Epidemiologists Conference in June, so we can all get together, CDC and state and local health departments, to discuss what tools we need to develop that would be useful for people at the state and local level to better address the threat. So nothing specific right now, but there are discussions developing a toolkit, perhaps, with questionnaires. And again, we're happy to provide technical assistance to anyone who would like some.
Thank you. Jill, do we have a question on the phone?
We have a question from Carol Burley. Ma'am, please state your organization.
Mojave Mental Health Clinic. My question is, how long does the psychosis last usually, or what's the longest it's lasted?
I'll give that a stab. This is Bob Galley. We found that most patients, even those that were requiring intensive care admissions, the drug would probably clear between 6 and 16 hours, which is why the 23-hour hospitalization was the most common. And while that was a, quote, psychotic reaction, it was typically associated with the drug itself. It was the rare patient where this set off a true psychiatric event that required hospitalization on our site floors.
Thank you.
Jill, do we have another question on the phone?
We have no more questions at this time, Mr. Khan. Once again, please press star 1 and record your name to ask a question.
While we're waiting for more questions on the phone, I do have another question to the webinar system that I would like to pose to our presenters. This question, to give context, seems to allude to some international drug safety considerations. The question is there any international pressure to stop the manufacturing and or importing of these products that you're aware of?
I can address that. This is Bob Galley once again. I have had reasonable contact with, one, the Mississippi Bureau of Narcotics, but more importantly, the DEA. Most all of this is now coming from China. The United States manufacture of the actual chemicals has been close to eliminated. Of course, once the drug is sent here, it does need to be mixed up in order to be able to be used and distributed. And so each statewide agency is working on that. But, you know, the interaction with China is really the most important thing. I don't know if anyone has seen it, but I would recommend that you do go to HBO's presentation of a show called Vice, where they literally toured one of the chemical manufacturers in China to see how these things were made. There is a lot of interdiction of drug that is being sent from China to the United States by DEA, but in order to put pressure on their country to stop this, you know, that gets into a relatively high negotiating political level.
Thank you, sir. Jill, do we have a question on the line?
We have one from LaFonda Plus. Please state your organization, ma'am.
Yes, ma'am. I'm with the city of Texarkana, Texas.
Go right ahead, ma'am.
Okay. My question is there a specific drug screen that will detect these chemicals?
So this is Bob Galley once again. That's kind of the reason why this is used. There isn't. If you look at something like marijuana, there is really one active ingredient, and that is THC. In order to develop some kind of a testing device, an awful lot of research needs to go into it in order to do that in relatively quick fashion. We use urine drug screens for a variety of chemicals, but these are stable chemicals that are the same chemical each time, and so therefore it's relatively easy to process. The synthetic cannabinoids number into the many hundreds of chemicals, and so there would have to be developed a separate chemical test for each and every one of those. As you saw from the screen that I showed, when we had 200 samples sent in, there were probably as many as 30 different chemicals that were identified. And in order to do that, it's really hard. The classic example is one guy who we had. EMS was called as well as the police because he was out on the streets of Jackson with no shirt on and his pants and underwear down to his ankles. He was flopping around in the grass with about 15 people videotaping him. EMS was able to, since he had an exposed buttock, give him a hit of Geodon, and he came in. Looking through his clothes to try to identify him, in one pocket I found a pay stub which showed that he was a security guard, which meant that he was going to be drug tested relatively frequently. So if he used synthetic cannabinoids, he would test negative. In his other pocket was a Mississippi Department of Corrections probation officer. He was in the early release program. Once again, tested frequently. There just is no way to be able to do this unless you're in a super sophisticated lab that most hospitals just cannot do.
And this is Dr. Arnold as well. I'll just also add, the other challenge, and there is there are a few commercial labs that are starting to develop assays for this, but the challenge is going to be understanding that specific drug screen, what it does and does not test for, and the rapid evolution of the different iterations of these drugs. And so, if there is a commercial assay, you test the patient. If it does result positive for one of the drugs that they test, that may be helpful. If it tests negative, it still is very difficult to interpret that because you don't know if it's testing negative because the drug is not there or it's testing negative because this is a new iteration of a drug that isn't part of that panel yet. So even as you start to come to market, which I anticipate they probably will at some point, interpreting these drug screens is not going to be as simple as a positive or a negative result.
And this is Dr. Galley again. In Mississippi in particular, the first generation drugs can be tested for, but that would be the spice and K2, and we almost never see that on the streets anymore.
But they don't see that very much anymore. They're progressing them. Awesome.
Thank you so much. Jill, do we have another question on the line?
We have no further questions at this time, sir.
Okay. While we're waiting to see if we have any more questions, I will do one more question from the webinar system, and this goes along with the previous question. Dr. Casper, are you aware of the CDC developing any methods to measure or analyze these chemicals in clinical specimens?
Thank you for that question. No, there is no current plans to do that at this time, though it is that is something that we would like to explore at some point. That's not being discussed right now.
Thank you, Dr. Casper. Jill, do we have any questions on the phone line? Okay, hearing none, I would like to, on behalf of COCA, thank everyone for joining us today with a special thank you to our presenters, Drs. Casper, Galley, and Arnold. We invite you to communicate with our presenters after the webinar. If you have additional questions for today's presenters, please email us at coca@cdc.gov. That's coca@cdc.gov. Put March 31st COCA call in the subject line of your email, and we will ensure that your question is forwarded to the presenters for a response. Again, that email address is coca@cdc.gov. The recording of this call and the transcript will be posted to the COCA website at emergency.cdc.gov/COCA within the next few days. Free continuing education is available for this call. Those who participated in today's COCA call and would like to receive continuing education should complete the online evaluation by April 30th, 2016, using course code WC2286. For those who will complete the online evaluation between May 1st and March 31st, 2017, use course code WD2286. All continuing education credits and contact hours for COCA calls are issued online through TCE Online, CDC's Training and Continuing Education Online System, at www.cdc.gov/TCE Online. To receive information on upcoming COCA calls, subscribe to COCA by sending an email to coca@cdc.gov. You can connect with COCA on Facebook, like our Facebook page at facebook.com/CDC Clinician Outreach and Communication Activity to stay connected to the latest news from COCA. Thank you again for being a part of today's COCA webinar. Have a great day.
That does conclude today's conference call. We thank you all for participating. You may now disconnect and have a great rest of your day.